You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a restaurant where you decide how much to pay could soon be a reality for Madison area residents. We'll find out how that restaurant aims to employ military veterans and help cut back on food waste. Now, the state budget process continues, and one area that's getting a closer look is funding for conservation efforts, in particular the program called the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program, which is typically funded on a 10-year basis. This time around, Governor Evers only allotted 2 years of funds and called for a committee to study the program's future. Representative Joel Kitchens is a Republican member of the Wisconsin Assembly representing the 1st District, which includes Egg Harbor, Sturgeon Bay, and Algoma. He's the author of a bill that would fund the program for the full 10 years. Representative Kitchens, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, give us some background on the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Program. What does it do?
Well, it was begun in 1989, and it gets renewed every 10 years. And really what it does is preserve our outdoor heritage. It preserves, you know, important lands for hunting and fishing as well as just, you know, wildlife appreciation. And it does some public projects with municipalities so that they enhance outdoor recreational activities.
And not everything in Wisconsin government gets bipartisan support. This is one named after a governor from each party. This is something that, for the most part, Democrats and Republicans have gotten behind over the years, right?
Right. Generally, it has. And I think, honestly, I think appreciation of the outdoors is one thing that kind of binds us all together as Wisconsinites. So hopefully we can keep it bipartisan. There's certainly some opposition. There's different ideas of how much funding is appropriate. Mm-hmm. But in general, I think there's bipartisan support.
And before we get to the current state of affairs, I know this does everything from maybe a small bit of land in an urban area to really big tracts of land in more rural areas. Right. What are some of the things in your neck of the woods that might have benefited from this?
Yeah, well, some of them have been municipalities have purchased properties or done improvements, but a lot of it has been through our land trust that we have, the Door County Land Trust, it's a matching grant program. So they've been able to secure a lot of very valuable habitat. And, you know, it ties in with our tourism, certainly, that a lot of people like to visit those. I like to go hike in those areas, too.
So here we are now. As you mentioned, it's a 10-year cycle on this. We're due now, right? Governor Evers has a 2-year plan in his budget for this. You were thinking, let's go 10. Talk about that difference.
Yeah, you know, I'm not quite sure why that happened, why he didn't renew it. It was a little disappointing to me, I guess, and to some of the conservation groups. But, you know, I think it's something that needs to get done. I mean, I guess he wants to come together and look at it long term and all of that. And that's fine. But I think we need to commit to renewing it for 10 years. And again, I think all of the conservation groups that I've talked to really want that certainty going forward.
And funding levels have gone down somewhat over the last, decade or so. What have we seen when it comes to the annual funding?
Yeah, we're at about a little over $33 million now per year, and it has declined somewhat. Some of the opposition to the stewardship program has been in that they've bought up huge tracts of land in some rural areas, and in those counties, they don't have very much tax base, so that takes them off the tax rolls. So that's been basically the opposition to it. So we tried, when it was scaled back, Governor Walker at one point proposed putting a moratorium on it for 15 years. We saved it, but we just focused a little more on making sure that the lands that were bought and taken off the tax rolls were truly important lands, and to emphasize more of the other areas where we can have conservation easements to allow the public to use that property, but then it still stays on the tax roll. So it has been modified over the years, but I think the main purpose of it has been preserved.
Now, the governor's budget plan, which has a long way to go before it's approved or changed or whatever, it would, as I understand it, maintain current levels of funding. What are you looking for if we renew it for 10 years?
Yeah, his is actually using up what's already been allocated but has not been spent. You know, this is something we're going to need to negotiate. So, you know, we're not all on the same page. I'm, I guess, speaking for myself. But I would like to see it go forward at about the same level. There are some groups that would like it to go a lot higher, and then there are groups that would like it to disappear. So, you know, that's still going to be up for negotiation. I think, though, the current level has worked pretty well.
What would be the impact if the plan wasn't renewed, either now or after this 2-year plan?
Yeah, I think it would be really bad for Wisconsin in the long term. I think, again, there are lands that need to be preserved. Part of it goes into securing properties along our rivers as we do these studies of where the pollutants enter the rivers. If we can buy up or secure some of those properties along that to prevent the phosphorus and other pollutants from going into those waterways at that point. So all of that is very important, I think, as, you know, we're really making progress in cleaning up our waterways, and the stewardship program is certainly an important part of that.
Talking to Wisconsin Assembly Representative Joel Kitchens about the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program due for renewal. The governor's budget says 2 years. He says, no, let's go with the full 10 years. A question with any item in the budget is, how are we paying for it? You mentioned that the governor's plan just uses up existing funding now. Do you see a particular funding mechanism if we renew it for 10 years?
Well, actually, this is a bonding program. So, it's something we've been borrowing money for over the years. That's the way the program is set up because it's considered a long-term investment. So it would continue in that way. It'd be done through bonding.
Do you see this, again, getting back to this idea of bipartisanship, Wisconsin having this commitment to natural resources and conservation, do you see this something down the road that Democrats in the legislature and you and the governor's office can get together and come up with a good plan for?
I think so. There's certainly areas where the two parties are going to disagree. Obviously, those are the ones you hear about. But I think this is something where we will be able to reach some agreement. Again, there is always going to be arguments about what the amount of funding is, what the level would be. But I think in concept, I think we certainly can agree, and I would hope we'll be able to come together on it.
Going back to the one potential objection you mentioned, if I'm a local government official and I'm saying conservation's lovely, but you're taking property out of my property tax base, do you think there's enough effort on getting buy-in from local officials and saying, okay, what can we designate without hurting you guys?
Yeah, I think we have to include them, and in some areas where there is a lot of opposition, we need to really think whether it's appropriate to do that. So we always need to include those. I think we've gone more towards those conservation easements again, where they can stay on the tax rolls, but be preserved and allow the public to have access to them. And I think that's a lot more palatable to some of the people in those areas.
Now, if I can get technical for a minute, are you making this proposal to renew for 10 years as a separate bill, a piece of legislation?
No, I'm doing it. I did it through there may be some separate legislation. Mm-hmm. I did it through a budget amendment proposal. And there are a number of us in the assembly that have been working on this, trying to reach a consensus with other members to let it go through. Because, again, there are always going to be some people that would like to see it disappear.
And it gets complicated because the governor has his proposed budget. There's talk among some of your Republican colleagues of saying, thanks, but we're going to start from scratch and write up our own budget proposal. Does that difference make it complicated to get a particular item like this included in the final deal?
I'm pretty confident if we get this put in there and we pass it through the two houses that the governor would sign that. I don't think this would be – I can't imagine this being something he would veto. Don't want to get into the whole budget process because it's going to be complicated.
We'll be talking about that plenty in the months
to come.
I'm sure
you will. Yeah, definitely. But I think this one's one that if we get it put in there, I can't imagine him vetoing it out.
And finally, do you have a timeline on this budget amendment, getting it approved and passed in the assembly?
We'll be working on it over the next few weeks. I've turned in an amendment, and I know there are some other members that have done that as well. And we'll be having some meetings with kind of the key players that, have an interest in this program. And so I would hope over the next few weeks we can reach an agreement to get it in there.
Representative Kitchens, thanks a lot for coming up today.
Great. Thank you. Great to be here.
That was Representative Joel Kitchens, Wisconsin Assembly Representative from Door County. He was with us today to talk about the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program and his bill aimed at funding that program for another decade. Coming up, we hear from a Wisconsin chef who's hoping to make food for a good reason with his next restaurant, one that'll employ military veterans as chefs and run on a pay-what-you-can model. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from a Wisconsin chef who's planning to open a new restaurant that will train and employ military veterans and use grocery store excess goods for part of their supplies. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Playing the organ in church is not a remarkable thing. It happens every Sunday around the state. But playing the organ every week for over 3/4 of a century, that can be an amazing feat. UW Eau Claire Professor of Journalism Jan Larson has the story.
For nearly 8 decades... one Wisconsin farm girl has followed the music along the back roads of the bluffs high above the banks of the Mississippi. As the sun rises on Sunday morning, catching the mist off the alfalfa, a pickup truck crisscrosses the farmland on its way to morning services. Sunday church, weddings, funerals, private lessons, recitals, all have made her a fixture up and down the river towns of Highway 35, leading one local to remark, "Ain't but nobody what lives or dies but what don't know Luella Detling."
My name is Luella Detling. I was born September 29th in 1928. I have been playing piano for for 81 years. My mother had one. I don't remember not having a piano and hearing her play. I grew up kind of around Stockholm, and then my parents bought a farm that was very close to Maiden Rock. I always lived on the farm. I remember her trying to start me playing when I was 6 years old. And I was a rather tomboy. I had a couple of brothers, so I was outside with them. I just really wasn't interested. I wanted to go outside and play. And then when I was seven, then she said, I decided that we're gonna try this again. She said, I just plain grabbed a hold. I wanted to play. Music has always been a joy. I would just sit right there by my mother and watch her fingers, just watch them and just listen. She was the organist and did all the playing in the church. But this morning, I remember getting ready and she said, I just don't feel good today. I don't think I can do this. She said, I think you can do that, so you go. I was 9 years old. That was gonna be my first church service. And there were no bulletins in those days, and they didn't tell you what you were going to be playing. I got married, and we moved to a farm. And, you know, when you are trying to get started making a living, and you do not buy pianos. I didn't think much about it, but she did. She called me up one day, and she said, there's a truck coming, and I want you to stay right there now, she said, so don't go anywhere. I don't know whether I had any idea what she had done or not, but it didn't take long, and she had bought a piano for me. So when she did that, she said, I was so afraid that if you didn't have a piano, you'd lose it. Think of the joy I've had. Tomorrow is Sunday, so I will be up about 5 o'clock. I'll go down to the two churches and take care of those on Sundays, as long as I'm able to do that. Only God knows when that will be, when I won't be doing it anymore. It's been a joy. It really has. It's been a good part of life.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, an established Madison area chef has been busy working on opening a new restaurant, this one based on a unique pricing model, Pay What You Can. This means the meals can be affordable for everyone with prices based on what consumers can offer. And there's some other unique twists to the restaurant. Chef Dave Heide runs two restaurants currently, Liliana's in Fitchburg, named for his daughter, and Charlie's on Main in Oregon, named for his son. A graduate of Le Cordon Bleu, he has worked at a Michelin-starred restaurant in California, as well as several restaurants in Wisconsin. He's planning to open a third restaurant called Little John's this summer. Chef Dave, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, one twist, I understand, usually you open a restaurant, fingers crossed, to make money.
Mm-hmm.
This time it's a nonprofit.
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things, so Liliana's and Charlie's do a ton of nonprofit work in the community. And in doing so much, we really got to see how much of a need there is out there. You know, one of the things we saw, though, is when we would donate food, like from Liliana's or Charlie's, a lot of times when we would donate, it was going to a gala for a bunch of people who had money and not actually the people who needed it, right? And so The whole thing actually started about 2 years ago. Me and Patrick DePula, who owns Sal's Tomato Pies, we did this food sustainability conference in at Madison College, and we thought we were going to, we called up Tim Metcalf. We were like, do you have any excess groceries that we can use? Because we're trying to curb food waste. We thought we'd get like 5 grocery bags worth of food, and we ended up filling up 8 8-foot stainless steel tables with food, full of grocery bags. So about 30 feet of stacked 3 feet wide of garbage, of grocery bags full of food.
Now, the menus, the restaurant's scheduled to open this summer. That's what you're aiming for, right? Now, the thing that your restaurant customer will probably notice first is the pricing model. It's a little different. How is this going to work?
Yeah, so the whole idea is pay what you can. So if you have money, great. Maybe pay $10 for your sandwich. If you don't have anything, don't worry about it. If you have a little bit, throw in a little bit. If you have a lot of money, throw in a bunch. It'd be great. And all of that. So we're going to be going into a restaurant that has a decent flow of traffic. And our hope is that we generate enough revenue from that one store that all the excess revenue that it does generate, we can take out in food carts to places that have food deserts, like soon to be Park Street when the new Cops opens up, or like the Allied Drive neighborhood, or we have like 32 different food insecure neighborhoods in Madison. So to be able to take food carts into those neighborhoods with our excess food and with the excess revenue to help generate them and sustain them.
Now, I know some bands occasionally, Radiohead has done a pay what you want album model. Do you have role models when it comes to restaurants? Have you seen this or heard of it done anywhere else?
Well, Bon Jovi has one, so that's always fun.
Bon Jovi has a restaurant, not an album. That's pay what you want.
Pay what you can restaurant. Huh. And there are...
So you're halfway there.
I'm right halfway there. I do sing in the shower. So, like, I feel like I'm pretty close. You know, one of the things that I was really hoping for is I was really hoping for a way to help... help you, because we throw away 40% of all food produced in the United States, 40%, and that's pre-consumer. So that's before it even gets to you. We throw away 40%. And I was like, how silly is it that we're just throwing it away when we have all these people who are living in food insecurity?
Right. So that's part two of the thing. There's the pay what you want.
Yeah.
So people who can pay support this, people who can't get food, get access to food.
Yeah.
Part two is you're trying to cut back on food waste. So how, what's the supply system looking like here?
So we're working with grocery store excess. So a lot of people, when we say the words food waste, you tend to think of like the stuff you throw out
in
the fridge,
tomato.
Right? Yeah, like the bag of liquid asparagus that sat in the back of your fridge for like a week and a half. But what really happens is I want you to think about when you go to a grocery store and you buy a quart of tomato or of strawberries. What's the first thing you do? You lift it up and you look at the bottom of the strawberries, and one little moldy one little bit of moisture or brown leaf on your strawberry, which you don't even eat, you put the whole thing back. Well, everybody does that, and so that whole quart of strawberries ends up getting thrown in the trash, right? But if that same thing was in your house, what would you do? You'd pick out the one bad one, you'd throw it away, and you'd use the rest. So, and a lot of it is even bad. A lot of it is like tomatoes that have a tiny little brown dot on them that's not even bad, right? Or like one little bruise. Or like another thing that'll happen is you'll have a grocery store who will, they can only buy about 25 pounds of tomatoes at a time. They'll buy 25 pounds of tomatoes, but then there are 5 pounds of tomatoes still out. And they're like, oh man, we can't still have these out because the new ones look way better. So you just throw away 5 pounds of perfectly good tomatoes for no reason other than they've got prettier ones. Exactly.
Talking to Chef Dave Heide, Madison area restaurant owner, about his new project, a nonprofit restaurant coming up this summer called Little John's. Pay what you want, trying to cut back on food waste. And now part three, I guess, Chef Dave, you're looking to employ military veterans at the restaurant.
Absolutely. And that was actually a couple different reasons why. One, I have a bunch of friends who are military vets. And, you know, we hear about PTSD all the time. But we don't really hear about is depression. So since 1999, we've lost about 5,500 troops to live action combat. And in that same time period, we've lost 158,000 to suicide. So we lose about 27 vets a day to suicide. And this isn't meant to completely eliminate that, but it's meant to say when people come back from being deployed, one of the biggest things they face is this lack of sense of purpose, right? They don't have, what do you do now? You know, like you've been doing one job for a long time, but honestly, legally, there's not a lot of options to do that same job when you get back home. They try out a bunch of different stuff and then they kind of don't find success. We're trying to get people right when they're coming back from the military to say, hey, you have a new brotherhood you can work with chefs. And to be honest, one of the other reasons we wanted to work with vets is that, you know, we've got kind of a wonderful, beautiful tree-hugging hippie concept, right? I mean, we've got food sustainability and food access for those in need and all these wonderful, great things. But, you know, we have a different segment of the population who looks at that and says, well, people should work harder and then they can afford to buy their food, or, you know, who cares, throw it away, we can grow more. But then once you say, hey, but we're also working with vets, it's a great way to get kind of both parties working together.
Well, it's a model of because this is providing a service, this is a community that has done a job that is all about service to their country in that case. So it, in some ways, it's a, maybe a more natural fit than it might look like at first.
Well, it fits great. And there's also, you know, in a kitchen, we have the same kind of like hierarchy structure, right? You have executive chef, sous chef, line cook, prep cook. Everyone has their place. Everyone answers up. And it leads to a much more kind of controlled environment for people when they come back.
Well, I guess people are intimidated by executive chefs sometimes. But if you've worked with a drill sergeant in the past, that
it's
chef isn't so
bad.
Scary all of a
it's
sudden.
It's not that bad. You do enough KP, you're good to go.
So, all right. In our last minute and a half or so, Dave, what's the roadmap now from here to grand opening?
Sure. So right now we are we have a location, but we've been done about 10 pop-ups now. And in each one, we realize how much food excess there is. And if you picture, you know, eight tables worth of food times the 60 grocery stores in the Madison area, there just wasn't enough. So now we're looking for a big processing facility. We're working with the city of Madison. They've been amazing to work with. So we're working on having kind of a central processing area and then opening up a couple different satellite stores within the next year.
Holy cow. We talked about a restaurant this whole time. What kind of food are you going to serve here?
So one of the cool things about a restaurant is the menu changes literally every single day.
Okay.
So literally every day it'll be something different. You'll have 7 to 8 options to choose from. Every day something different. So sandwiches or salads or pastas, always something different.
Fantastic. Chef Dave, thanks again for joining us in the studio.
Always happy, man. Love to be here.
That was Madison area chef Dave Heide. He owns two restaurants, Liliana's in Fitchburg, Charlie's on Main in Oregon, both named after his kids. I guess there's a third kid.
That's
why we opened the third restaurant.
Little John's will be the restaurant nonprofit hiring veterans trying to cut back on food waste. Pay what you want. Coming up, computer programs control much of our world, from the brakes in our cars to the emails we send at work. But who are the people who create all that code, and what do they do in their day? We learn about the world of coding, past, present, and future, coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on the morning show, Kate Archer Kent is hosting the show from our studio in Superior. She'll look at conservation efforts in northern Wisconsin involving tribes, local governments, and landowners. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, think about how much time you spend on your phone or a computer every day. Then think about how much you know about the code that makes everything work. Computer programmers or coders have a lot of influence on our lives, from our medical records to social media to the innards of our cars and appliances. But who are they, and what do they actually do? Clive Thompson is a journalist who writes about science and technology. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, a monthly columnist for Wired Magazine, and writes a periodic column about the history of technology for Smithsonian Magazine. His new book is Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. Clive, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Well, talk about coders. It's this job that's, as you write, incredibly influential in our lives and yet largely invisible to us. It's kind of a weird combination.
It really is. I mean, when you think about it, there's almost nothing you can do these days outside of maybe like taking a walk in the woods that does not use software, right? You know, you wake up, you know, you look at your phone, check your email, you know, every time you're in your car, it's basically like a thing run by software now. And, you know, payroll, GPS, everything, software essentially has become the operating system for the way we live. And so what that means is the people that write it and the people that, you know, get an idea for something new, you know, like, hey, you know, I've got this idea for this crazy Facebook thing, or, you know, I have this idea for this Instagram thing or this Google thing. Those people have an enormous amount of power on how we live our lives, because they create you know, they create new abilities. They let us do things that we couldn't do before. Sometimes they make it so much fun to do it that we do it a ton. And that's why I sometimes think of software developers as, you know, kind of the unacknowledged legislators of reality right now.
You've done some coding yourself, and you spent a lot of time in your book watching people at work, interviewing them. For those of us who haven't done it, I mean, what does the job of a coder look like?
Well, you know, if you were to look at a movie or a TV show, often you'd see someone, you know, if they were a coder sitting there and they're just typing all the time and like they're just typing and the code is flowing out of them. That is not even remotely what coding is actually like, because when you're coding, what you're doing is it's really just taking a complicated thing that you have to do, like, you know, I don't know, take this photo that I posted and look for any faces in it and identify them and send those names out to a different place. It's breaking everything down step by step by step, painfully minute steps. You have to be very specific. And when you're writing those instructions out in software, if you make the slightest error, everything stops working. So it's really easy to make mistakes. And so a lot of coding is actually someone writing like 4 or 5 lines of code or 10 lines of code and checking to see, okay, did this one little thing that I tried to get the computer to do, does this one little thing work? And 9 times out of 10, it doesn't. Like, there's already something you've done wrong because you haven't thought through carefully every little step, or maybe you even just made a stupid typo, like you put a comma in the wrong place. And these things break software. So a lot of coding is really sitting there with something broken and trying to fix it and just staring at the screen, baffled, and being unbelievably frustrating. That's what coding is kind of like.
It sounds like there's a love-hate relationship. And you quote someone, I'm going to clean up the language here, but someone who says, all right, think of coding and working with a computer as working with an amazing jerk all day who basically, if you don't tell it exactly what you want him or her to do, they're going to get it wrong. And that can wear on a person, it sounds like.
Oh, my God. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a thing, like, you know, if you talk to a developer who has been, you know, grinding away for hours and hours, and sometimes if you're really trying to get in there deep, you know, you're at it for 5, 10, 15 hours. When they come away from that, they have been dealing with the most linear, the most prissy, grammatically, you know, focused, picky, you know, annoying colleague, the computer. And it kind of, you know, a lot of them told me it can kind of rub off on you, right? Like, you know, if you get someone right at the end of a big bug hunt, they can be, you know, very, you know, pissy and kind of, you know, linear and, you know, and kind of like, you know, oh, you didn't say that exactly correctly. I'm not going to answer your damn question, because that's kind of what they were doing for the last 10 hours, right? You know, it rubs off on you.
Talking to Clive Thompson about his new book, Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World, about the people who write the software that shapes our lives, even often if we don't notice it. Well, to that point, Clive, you look at stereotypes of computer programmers and their personalities. Is there a modal coder? Is there a coding personality?
Yeah, there's definitely some strong commonalities. Here's what you typically find, and what I found when I talked to like about 200 of these developers over the last couple of years. One is that they're all really good at thinking logically, at breaking those complicated things down into little pieces. Amazing at doing that type of thing. Second thing is they're very meticulous. They have to be, you know. So, and they're meticulous often, not always, but very frequently in other ways too. Like, they're precise in the way they communicate, right? And they can be annoyed when someone is not precise in the way they communicate. They're really good at dealing with frustration. They have to be, right? You know, like if you're gonna deal with bugs all day long, you're gonna be like that. But here's one of the surprises. This one is interesting. This one came up over and over again. They are very impressed by and excited by efficiency, taking something that is happening in a slow or ponderous way and speeding it up, or taking something that involves a lot of really boring, repetitive work and automating it so the computer does it for you. They do that so much in their jobs. That's what a lot of software is. It's really taking something that's, you know, kind of being done by humans and saying, no, let's have the computer do this, because they're much faster and they're much more regular and much more precise. They do that so much that it starts to become almost offensive when they're presented with something that's inefficient. Like, it becomes like a I think of it like an aesthetic, like things that are done by hand or repetitively are almost like gross to them. Like, why would you do that when you have these computers that can do this stuff? So they become very, very swept up with and excited by, in almost a spiritual way, with efficiency.
And that can have a downside. You're right that it's a virtue in programming itself, but there's an almost chilling example. There was a coder you talked to who said, yeah, people kept bugging me. You never call, you never write. So he came up with a computer program to periodically randomly email someone with a series of stock phrases randomly chosen to make it look like he was reaching out, and he's doing it really efficiently. It seems like there's a downside there somewhere, Clive.
Totally. I mean, like, and, you know, developers themselves would say this to me. They say, like, you know, look, one of the problems is that, you know, I spend all my time thinking about how to torque things and make them more efficient and get rid of repetitive actions. And the problem is a lot of social activity, like a lot of, you know, us just being decent humans to each other, involves a lot of these very repetitive rote statements. Hey, how are you doing? You know, what's up? How's the weather? You know, these are this sort of social glue, and we sort of expect it from each other, but it can start to become to a certain type of developer, not all of them, but quite a few of them, that becomes almost something that's annoying in and of itself. And I think when you think, you look at the problems that social software, you know, like social networks, Twitter or Facebook or whatnot, when you look at the problems that they have posed for the world, for the civic world, a lot of it, I think, ultimately has to do with the fact that those were all attempts to take human socializing and make it radically faster and more efficient, right? You know, that is how Mark Zuckerberg talked about Facebook. He talked about it as, I want to increase information flows. Like, I want to speed up the flow of how much we know about what everyone else is doing and thinking. And it turns out that that can be really great in a lot of ways, but it can have some fantastic side effects that I think society is now grappling with.
A story that runs through your book is the idea of who the type of person is who goes into computer programming when it comes to gender and race. And mostly we have the stereotype, and I think the numbers bear it out, white men, some Asian men. But it wasn't, you write, always that way. Women were dominant in the early days of coding and software in a lot of ways.
That's exactly right. In the very early days of coding, like the late 50s and the early 60s, when you first started seeing these big room-sized machines come out of the lab and out of the university and into large corporations who began using them for everything from payroll to data analysis, it was a surprisingly meritocratic period. No one knew how to code. There was no classes you could take in it. So when they had to hire coders, they didn't have any mental image of who a coder might be. They just sort of took anyone who was interested in proving that they were good at logic puzzles, you know, basically, and then they would train them on the job. And so it was a very open door, and a lot of women were coders, were very elite coders, in fact. Something on the order of 1 in 4 programmers in 1960 were women, which is astonishing when you consider how sexist that period was in every other way. Like, they were certainly not 1 in 4 doctors or 1 in 4 mechanical engineers or anything like that. But this was a very, very open door. And that closed over time. That got worse. I mean, in 2013, which is the most recent figures I have, the net percentage of women in coding is actually slightly less than in 1960. It was 26%, which is amazing, because every other technical field just saw sort of a steady increase of women. Coding is one of the few ones that actually went backwards.
And one consequence of that, you write, that a lot of people are concerned about, is that if you don't have a mix of different people from different backgrounds in the room coming up with plans, you don't think about how things might affect different people. So without women in the planning stages of, say, Twitter, people weren't worried about the horrific harassment that quickly emerged on Twitter.
Right, exactly right. I mean, any Harvard Business Review study would sort of bear out the fact that if you have a complicated problem you're dealing with, particularly a social problem, you want to have people from a lot of different walks of life in the room brainstorming it, you know, because that's how you're going to make sure you solve for all these, what in software you would call all these edge cases of possible things that can go wrong. That was not at all the case in the early days of social software. It was a lot of young white guys in the room. By that point in time, software had become a lot of young white guys. And the young is actually also an issue too, right? Like, you know, if they'd had some developers in their 40s and 50s around. They could have said, you know, whoa, youngsters, you know, back in the 90s, we had discussion groups and they often turned into crap storms of harassment. So if you're going to build this thing called Twitter, that's great, but let's get ahead of this problem. So some of the problem is not just they didn't have any women. They didn't even have any people, middle-aged people, like, you know, Silicon Valley is very ageist too, right? You know, like even if you're like sort of a, you know, like a male programmer, by the time you're in your 40s and 50s, you're often shoved at the pasture. So the fact that they had this very small group of people who had really no or very little experience of being asked on meant that they, the folks in Twitter and to a certain extent Facebook too and many other social networks sort of didn't think to deal with it. And that's one of the reasons why they were caught flat-footed years later and why they're still kind of trying to figure out how to deal with it. Because if you create a social network that's based on everyone openly talking to everyone all the time as your base structure, it's going to be pretty hard if you haven't mapped out some war games, some of those problems to deal with it a decade on.
We're talking to Clive Thompson, a journalist who writes about science and technology. His new book is called Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a programmer or do you have experience with coding yourself? What do you wish the rest of the world understood about what you do? Are there things you wish you knew about coding that you don't? Are you thinking about going into the field? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Clive Thompson, science and technology journalist writing for The New York Times Magazine and elsewhere. His new book is called Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. We're talking about the people who make the software that shapes so much of our lives. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a coder, a programmer yourself, we'd love to hear from you about what you do, what it's like, what the job light is like, and what you wish people knew about it. Or if you have a question about how all this stuff works, call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to a caller now. Robbie is with us in Apple River, Illinois. Robbie, hi.
Hello. Can you boys hear me okay?
Sure. What did you want to ask about, Robbie?
I was just wondering, how soon does he think AI will alleviate their job requirements and positions, much like they are developing systems that are alleviating other people's jobs.
Interesting. So when can we have computers that program computers, Clive, I guess?
That's a great question, and one that a lot of programmers worry about, right? Because, you know, they sit around thinking, I'm a lot of coding. It requires great insight and great hard work, but there is some rote activity in there, right? You know, and you could automate that. So the short answer is, I think over the next few years, we will probably see AI assisting quite a lot with programming. They're already working on developer tools that let you, you know, start, you know, mapping at what you want to do and having it auto-suggest or auto-complete some stuff that could move you along a lot more quickly. But I think we're probably still, you know, at least a decade or maybe more out from being able to fully, you know, have an AI create something that is complicated. So I think developers are safe for some time.
Thanks for that call, Robbie. We go now to Cody in Madison. Cody, hello.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Cody?
I just had a comment about coding, and it was the fact that it's hard to get people to understand what you're doing with a computer by typing in, like, a, you know, we're typing in human language and the machine's just compiling it and it's a binary. So it's quite hard, the translation, to see what's going on there.
Cody, go ahead.
The differences in the way different program interfaces call things, such as like functions, methods, whatnot. A lot of the things are the same, but they call them different things with different programs, if that makes sense.
Cody, thanks a lot for the call. And Clive, I know people write, they program in a lot of different programming languages. I understand there are very heated debates that I can't follow about which is best for which purpose. This is a big deal for coders.
It's true, actually. Well, you see, here's the thing. see, this is the thing that's sort of interesting and I think kind of, you know, neat about coding languages is that on the one hand, they're very similar. They're all kind of basically telling, you know, if allow you to say if this, then do that, right? You know, if this or whatnot. They all are good at some things and bad at others. So a lot of coders will gravitate towards certain languages because they sort of find it fits their, I don't know, it fits their intellectual hand like a glove, and they love it. But, you know, you will get some really serious holy wars over which languages are, quote unquote, the best. If you want some glimpse of that, go to a website for coders like Stack Overflow and type in, does JavaScript suck? And just behold the fascinating arguments around that language, which is used inside browsers.
Thanks for that call, Cody. We're talking about the book Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. Author Clive Thompson is with us. Back to your calls now. Curtis is on the line in Waukesha. Curtis, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead, Curtis. What did you want to tell us about?
So I'm a student in software engineering right now, graduating next year. And something I've noticed is that anybody who talks to me about what I'm learning about, like I'll say, oh yeah, I do programming or something, their first reaction is always, oh, I could never do that. And I have a completely different opinion about most people because I think anybody who's intelligent, they're able to understand the concepts. They just put it on this other mental level thinking that they could never actually do it. But I think they can. And I just think there's so many more people who would love to code if they just didn't separate themselves from being able to do it.
Curtis, thank you so much for that call. And Clive, I want to point toward the last chapter in your book. Part of that chapter, you talk about a project in, I think it was Kentucky, trying to get coal miners into the world of coding.
Yeah, that caller, Curtis, is absolutely correct. There is a sort of mystique around coding that makes it seem like it's something that, you know, mere mortals could never get. Not at all true. Anyone who likes to be meticulous and is willing to do the hard work, I think, can learn this. In fact, you know, I myself, like I'm a journalist. I did some coding when I was a kid. I didn't really pursue it in my 20s and 30s. In my 40s, when I started working on this book, I decided I was going to learn a little bit more. And, you know, I learned a whole bunch that's really useful in my job. These guys down in Kentucky, they're miners, and they wanted to create some sort of work that was not going to collapse the way mining was. So they created a software firm, and they got a senior programmer to come in and train 11 of them. They all picked it up absolutely great. I mean, as the leader of this company, Rusty Justice, told me, he said, look, you know, coal miners already deal with a lot of technology down there in the mines. They're patient. They have to be. They have to sit there for 10 hours in a mine. They have to solve problems. And so I interviewed these guys, and they were all like, yeah, I mean, it was hard, but, like, mining's hard, too. Like, everything's hard. If you are someone who can work and persist and just get through the frustration, you absolutely can learn coding.
In our last minute, Clive, what are you hoping people take away when you lift the veil into the world of coding?
Well, I actually think that I would like to see a little bit less mystique around it, exactly along the lines of what Curtis is talking about, for two reasons. One is I think it will make everyone slightly more informed in thinking about the reason that the modern world works the way it does. You know, it'll make them hopefully a little more usefully skeptical about the claims of software companies, maybe make them a little excited about the possibilities of things that could be done that aren't being done. And for the subset of people who are interested in maybe trying it out themselves, I absolutely would encourage them because I think that there's something also artful and creative and fun in this discipline that I tried to evoke in the book too.
Clive, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I had a great time.
We've been talking to journalist Clive Thompson. His latest book is called Coders, The Making of a New Tribe and the Remaking of the World. If this is you, if you're a coder or just getting into it now, let us know your story. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a new report says Social Security will not be able to make payments at the full level starting in about 16 years. We'll find out what that means and what it could take to set it on a better path between now and then. A criminal justice reform advocate says Governor Evers should push for more changes in Wisconsin's prison system in his state budget plan and beyond. And new parents get a lot of advice, lots, but the evidence doesn't always back it up. An economist puts the biggest child-raising theories to the test, and she'll join the show to share some of her results. That and a look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, let's go to Mars. That's the message from Kate's guest, a longtime supporter of exploration and human settlement on the Red Planet. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people and examine how they're affecting American and global culture and politics. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.